Good afternoon, everyone. A very happy Sabbath to you all. Isn't it nice to have some sunshine? Just makes us feel so much better. I'm hoping that this means spring is just going to keep coming. I'm not sure if that will be the case, but just really looking forward to going outside and playing and with the kids and letting them run around. Cabin fever for 6 months is a long winter. I'd like to welcome everyone on the webcast also. Always nice to have that opportunity to participate in services. And we've got quite a full house today, so it's great to see everyone. We have a strong will to live, don't we? A desire to survive for self-preservation. God created us with a desire to live. I'd like to begin the message today with a few examples that I think illustrate this strong drive within humanity to live, to survive during difficult times. Most of you probably remember the movie Castaway, starring Tom Hanks. It's a captivating story about a man's will to survive after a plane crash leaves him stranded on an island alone for 4 years. His only companion, you'll remember, was a volleyball he named Wilson. Of course, the story goes on. Eventually, he finds a way to leave the island, to get off the island, and he's discovered by a passing cargo ship, and he returns back to society. There are other ways that our drive for self-preservation manifests. We all see what happens after natural disasters or other catastrophic events take place, especially in the very poor countries. Looting, hoarding, the law of the jungle takes over, becomes chaos. Recently, the CDC has made a public announcement asking people to stop buying, in essence, hoarding face masks so the medical industry has sufficient supplies. So even the recent coronavirus reminds us of the panic that can be instilled in the world through viruses like this and, of course, how social media and things like that influence it. But our desire to protect ourselves, that's why we're all going out to buy face masks, because we want to live, we want to survive, we don't want to catch this. And thirdly, we all like stories about underdogs. People enjoy those stories. And we've seen that throughout history, especially when it comes to warfare. People who in the past may have had their differences band together to beat the odds, to win the battle. A great example of this is another movie, an apocalyptic movie called Independence Day, starring Will Smith. The whole world ends up uniting by the end of the movie to fight the alien invasion. We have a strong desire to live. Today, self-defense is all the rage, and it continues to grow in popularity as world events, as governments, and society in general leave everyone very, very cynical. No one trusts each other. If you Google and search what the word self-defense, the most common results that will show up are information on the techniques. How do you defend yourself? YouTube videos and advertisements for classes. People put great value on this skill, the skill to survive, the skill to protect oneself. And then, of course, there's the great divide in this nation over gun laws. What is self-defense? I think we all understand what it is. We all know what it means, but I'd like to read two definitions as a reminder from dictionary.com and Merriam-Webster's dictionary. The first is defined as the act of defending oneself, one's property, or a close relative. Pretty basic, pretty common. The second can be defined as a claim or a plea that the use of force or injuring or killing another was necessary in defending one's own person from physical attack. I read through the legal definition, which is long and detailed, but it basically states that a person is allowed to act at an equal level of that of which they were threatened. You know, if it's some kind of assault, they are allowed legally to react in kind. If it's a gun or some other weapon, they are allowed to react in kind. People have varying perspectives on self-defense. Is it right? Is it wrong? How should a Christian view self-defense. And the question we should most certainly ask is, what does the Bible say? What does the Bible say about this topic? The title for the split sermon this afternoon is Christians and Self-Defense. Christians and Self-Defense. So we read dictionary definitions of self-defense. What does the Bible say? What does it define it as? If you search this term, self-defense, in the Bible, you will receive zero results. It's not in there. Now, the principles and other information to piece together what the Bible stands for, what God's perspective is, we will certainly find, but it is not defined the way we understand it. Let's begin in Numbers chapter 35. Begin laying a foundation for this topic. Numbers chapter 35, the second to last chapter in the book of Numbers. And we'll begin reading in verse 9. God instructs Moses here in Numbers chapter 35, beginning in verse 9, about the cities of refuge. Verse 9, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. They shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment. Verse 13, and the cities which you give, you shall have six cities of refuge. You shall appoint three cities on this side of the Jordan, and three cities you shall appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger, and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there. So here we reread the first classification of killing someone, and that is accidentally. Verse 16 begins the other classification. But if he strikes him with an iron implement so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he strikes him with a stone in the hand by which one could die, and he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon by which one could die, and he does die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. So we read here about the cities of refuge to protect against vengeance. And then the last three verses we read that if anyone uses a weapon, it is considered murder. Something that has the potential of killing someone, it is considered murder. God doesn't give self-defense as an out, as a justification. He classifies two types of killing, accidental and intentional. Self-defense is something afforded to us by the law of the country we live in, but not by the law of God. So what is the definition of murder then? It means intentionally killing someone or intentionally harming someone and they end up dying. It's interesting to think about that. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 17, a few pages over. Okay. We'll turn and read from the second list of the Ten Commandments. Verse 17 lists the sixth commandment, very basic, four words, you shall not murder. You shall not murder. There's no wiggle room there. It says you shall not murder, period. God commands us to respect human life. Revelation chapter 22. Revelation chapter 22. It tells us who may enter God's kingdom and who may not. Revelation chapter 22, verse 14 and 15. Throughout the chapter, an angel and Jesus Christ are speaking to John and telling him what to write down. Verse 14, it says, blessed are those who do his commandments. We are blessed when we keep God's commandments. Blessed are those who keep his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into the city. But outside are dogs and sorcerers and sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and whoever loves and practices a lie. Jesus Christ teaches us that there is no place for anyone in God's family who is willing to take the life of another human being. There's no place for that. One more scripture to reference as we lay a foundation for the topic today, and that's Romans chapter 12, verses 18 through 20. It talks about who vengeance belongs to. It belongs to God. Vengeance belongs to God. So are we saying that we can never defend ourselves? We can never protect our families? What if someone tries to hurt them? Well, this all depends. The answer to this question all depends on our definition of self-defense. Let's keep going and see what the Bible teaches. Now that we've set a basic foundation, I'd like to look at a few examples, a few arguments that are used to support self-defense in Scripture, and go through those and see what Scripture says. There are many, many resources in researching this subject. So many resources the church has on this topic, from fundamental beliefs and Foundation Institute classes to study papers and Life Open Truth articles to Worldwide Church of God articles. There's a lot to be said on it. Great resources for sure. The first argument, the first example, is often said self-defense is justified in Scripture, including using force, if necessary, to defend against wrongful attacks. Because Jesus' disciples carried swords, even after 3 years of traveling with him. In the Garden of Gethsemane, they had swords. You can read in Luke chapter 22, verse 36, that Christ tells those who had no sword to go and buy one. Let's turn there, Luke chapter 22, verse 36. Did Jesus Christ support the use of weapons to defend ourselves or not? Let's read Luke 22. In verse 36, Luke chapter 22, verse 36, then he, Jesus Christ, then he said to them, but now he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack. And he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. It certainly sounds like Jesus Christ is supporting the use of swords to protect ourselves. In the first century, swords were used for that purpose. Very often were carried for protection. It makes sense that this would be the purpose for him to tell them to buy a sword. And I'm not being sarcastic. It does sound like that. But as we've been taught, anyone who's been in the church for any length of time, what does the context say? Early in chapter 22, the disciples prepare the Passover, that last Passover with Jesus Christ, and then Jesus Christ institutes the New Testament Passover, and then it brings us to what we just read, followed by Christ's arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. So this is the context surrounding these verses. Let's pick it up in verse 35, jump back up to verse 35, and read through this entire section down to verse 38. And he said to them, when I sent you without money bag, knapsack, and sandals, did you lack anything? They said, nothing. Then he said to them, but now he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack, and he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. Why is he saying two different things here? When he sent the 70 out, he sent them out without anything. Now he's saying, you need to prepare yourself. You need to have these provisions, including a sword. Why would he ask that? Is it different now? Let's continue, verse 37. For I say to you that this which is written must still be accomplished in me. And he quotes Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 12, and he was numbered with the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. I like to read that verse in a couple different translations because I think it speaks more to us in our modern language, our modern English. The contemporary English version says, "Do this because the scriptures say, he was considered a criminal. This was written about me, and it will soon come true." The Good News translation says, "He shared the fate of criminals." Holman Christian Standard Bible, the last one we'll read, says, "For I tell you, what is written must be fulfilled in me, and he was counted among the outlaws. Yes, what is written about me is coming to its fulfillment." Jesus Christ had to be considered an outlaw. Let's continue reading verse 38. "So they said, Lord, look, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough." It was enough. Two swords were enough to make Jesus Christ appear to be an outlaw, to appear to be a common criminal. In order for this prophecy to be fulfilled, in order to give the Pharisees an excuse to arrest him and treat him the way they did, he asked them to take two swords with them. It's interesting, but perhaps not convincing enough yet. How can we be sure that it's not okay to carry weapons for protection? Matthew chapter 26 gives a little more detail as the story continues. Matthew chapter 26. Here Christ, what we just read, Christ asked them to take swords. Let's see what he says in Matthew chapter 26. We'll begin in verse 47. Verse 47 of Matthew 26. It says, "And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude, with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him.'" Verse 49, "Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, 'Greetings, Rabbi,' and kissed him. But Jesus said to him, 'Friend, why have you come?' Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him." Verse 51, "And suddenly one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword, struck the servant of the high priest, and cut off his ear. But Jesus said to him, 'Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword.'" And we'll pause there. Earlier, Jesus Christ asked them to take their swords with them. Now he condemns the use of force. He doesn't even thank Peter for trying to defend him. I would guess Peter was expecting a thank you for having the courage to do that, don't you? Instead, he was rebuked. Why would Christ tell his disciples to take swords and then rebuke them for using them? I mean, is he contradicting himself? If you think about it, if there was ever a situation where it was justified to defend someone, it would be Jesus Christ, the only human being who never sinned. And yet it was still not okay in this case. Let's keep reading verse 53. Jesus Christ repeats what we already read previously in Luke 22 and verse 37. Verse 53, he says, "Or do you think that I cannot pray now to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus? In that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, 'Have you come out as against a robber, with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled.' Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." There's no contradiction. This prophecy needed to be fulfilled. But of course, this prophecy had a purpose. God doesn't do anything without a purpose. This is the proof, quote unquote, that the Jewish leaders needed to have in order to treat Jesus the way he was treated. In order for Christ to become the sacrifice that we all needed, that the whole world needed, he needed to be beaten, bruised, and killed, executed. And this was to assist in that. So the idea that Jesus Christ promoted self-defense because he instructed his disciples to carry swords is false. That wasn't the purpose at all, but instead to fulfill this prophecy. Another example, another question that comes up. What about the many examples of God's servants who fought and killed people? Men who we are told will be in God's kingdom and part of the first resurrection. Men like David, like Joshua, like Samson, even Abraham. Each one of them are listed in the faith chapter. What about them? What are we to make of the fact that they at times received God's favor in violence? Did they practice righteous violence or righteous vengeance? How can we understand this apparent contradiction? Well, clearly God allowed it, and he sometimes helped Israel and those in the Old Testament accomplish victory in battles. But that doesn't necessarily mean it was pleasing to God. 1 Chronicles chapter 22, we read about King David, a man after God's own heart. God was very pleased with David's character overall. Of course, we have read there's examples of David's flaws, but God called him a man after his own heart. Verse 5, 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verse 5. Now David said, Solomon, my son, is young and inexperienced, and the house must be built for the eternal. It must be exceedingly magnificent, famous, and glorious throughout all countries. I will now make preparation for it. So David made abundant preparations before his death. Then he called for his son Solomon and charged him to build a house for the eternal God of Israel. And David said to Solomon, My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build a house to the name of the eternal my God. David desired to build this house. He wanted to. Verse 8, But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight. Verse 9, Behold, a son shall be born to you, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies all around. His name shall be Solomon, for I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Verse 11, Now, my son, may the Eternal be with you, and may you prosper and build the house of the Eternal your God, as he has said to you. God told David that he was not allowed to build the temple. He was not allowed to build it because of his use of violence, many, many wars, and much shed blood. God was not pleased even with David in this regard. What many would consider righteous violence, godly vengeance. Matthew chapter 19. Just because God allowed some of this behavior doesn't mean he approved of it. Matthew chapter 19, Jesus Christ is tested by the Pharisees, as he often was. And it gives us some insight into why God would allow certain things and perhaps even seemingly support it. Why was it this way? We're going to begin in verse 1 of Matthew chapter 19. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished these sayings, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? And he answered and said to them, Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. God's original intent was for marriage to last a lifetime, not for separation. Verse 7, Then they said to him, Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And Jesus said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. From the beginning, it was not so. And this is talking about divorce, but the same principle applies to killing. It was not God's intent, and it still isn't his intent, and it never will be his intent. His law lays that out. Everyone will have the opportunity one day to have their hard heart of stone replaced with a heart of flesh. Let's turn next to Exodus chapter 23 and see how this applies to ancient Israel. This principle of how it was not God's intention from the beginning. Exodus 23, verse 23. Exodus 23, verse 23, God makes a promise to Israel. Verse 23, he says, "For my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Canaanites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off." Jump down to verse 27. "I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little, I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land." Verse 31. "And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the Sea Philistia, and from the desert to the river. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you." God intended for Israel to trust him in the conquest of the promised land. He promised he would drive the people out from before them. But that isn't what happened. That's not what history tells. We pick up the story in Numbers chapter 14, we see what did happen. What did happen? The Israelites often complained. They had trouble trusting in God. They rebelled against him frequently. Numbers chapter 14, verse 1, this is directly after the spies came back from the land of Canaan and shared how wonderful it was, but that wasn't the kind of reaction that they should have had hearing this news. Verse 1 of Numbers chapter 14, "So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Eternal brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let us select a leader and return to Egypt.'" They did this numerous times, wanting to turn back. When they finally decided to go forward, they didn't trust in God. Drop down to verse 39, Numbers chapter 14, verse 39. "Then Moses told these words to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly, and they rose early in the morning and went up to the top of the mountain, saying, 'Here we are, and we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised, for we have sinned.' And Moses said, 'Now why do you transgress the command of the Eternal? For this will not succeed. Do not go up, lest you be defeated by your enemies, for the Eternal is not among you. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and you shall fall by the sword because you have turned away from the Eternal. He will not be with you.'" And that is exactly what happened. It was too late. They changed their minds. Okay, we do want to go into the promised land. But instead of trusting in God, they trusted in themselves. Killing someone has never been pleasing to God. He has allowed it because of the choices people make. But there are always consequences for sin. Society tells us that we are weak if we're not willing to take a stand and fight to protect ourselves or to protect our family. Human nature is to fight back, to lash out when we're threatened. What this all really boils down to is what do I have faith in? Do I have faith in God? Do I have faith in myself? Christ told Peter, we read, he told Peter that God could send 12 legions of angels to his aid. Surely God can do this for us in moments when we need an aid, when we need to be defended. Daniel chapter 3. Quick turn to Daniel chapter 3. We know this story very well. Such a great example of faith, of bravery, of courage. These three young friends of Daniel's stand up to King Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to pick it up in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, that is, being forced to bow down to the gold image, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. That takes true courage. They could have allowed human nature to kick in, to fight back. Do we, as they did, do we trust in God's ability, his desire to shield us according to his will, or do we trust our limited physical abilities more? I asked earlier, are we saying there is no allowance for self-defense, no allowance for protecting ourselves or our families? Well, that depends on the definition of self-defense. If our definition includes taking someone else's life, if we use force to harm someone and they could potentially die, no, that is not biblical. That is not what God teaches. His instruction is clear. You shall not kill. You shall not murder. The problem with self-defense is not with defense, but with the word self. In the scenario of killing for self-defense, we are judging, we are deciding, we are determining that my life, your life, is more important than the one that we are willing to end. We're all sinners. No one deserves something other than the next. What gives us the right to make that judgment, to make that decision? The Bible teaches in many scriptures to value and to respect human life, all human life. Is my life more valuable than yours? Certainly not. We're all created as the pinnacle of God's creation. No other creature can say that. We're going to be in his family. We were made in his image. We have no right whatsoever to end someone else's life. So killing someone, even in self-defense, is a sin. It's never justified. What then can we do to protect ourselves? Do we do nothing to protect ourselves and our families? No, we can do many things to protect ourselves and our families. I've listed five things that we can do to protect ourselves, to protect our families, and they have nothing to do with killing another human being. First, we can make good choices. We can make good choices to avoid dangerous situations. We can make good choices and not get wrapped up with the wrong people. We'll go through these rather quickly. Second, if we do end up in a life-threatening situation, we can say a prayer, a quick prayer, to ask for God's divine and supernatural protection. I can guarantee you, Daniel's three friends were saying a prayer all the way to that furnace. Three, if circumstances allow, we can contact the police. We can contact the authorities to ask for help. Four, we can put ourselves between the attacker and our loved ones. Number five, it is not wrong to restrain someone until help arrives. It is not wrong to prevent them from harming someone. This can be a fine line, of course, but it is not wrong to prevent someone from harming your family, from harming yourself. As long as we don't determine to harm them, which could potentially kill them. The Bible doesn't teach us that we should do nothing to prevent harm. to ourselves or our families. He has no desire for us to be the world's punching bag, to just stand there and take everything. But at the same time, as we have studied today, Scripture is clear that taking someone's life is a sin. Like so many aspects of Christianity, self-defense ultimately comes down to attitude. It comes down to our heart. What's in our hearts? I'd like to conclude with a slightly different take on self-defense, some food for thought. We've been talking about physically defending ourselves this whole time, but that attitude, the attitude that prompts us to rationalize lethal force to defend ourselves physically, is the same attitude that rears its head during arguments and disputes, verbal interactions. We naturally want to win. We desire to win, to survive at all cost. That's human nature. Right now, we're in the middle of our Passover preparation, our annual concentrated effort to examine ourselves. Just because we've determined in our minds not to break the sixth commandment, even in self-defense, doesn't mean we've conquered this prideful desire to win, to survive. We've all interacted with individuals, people that can be difficult, that are defensive. They always have the last word in any disagreement, can't admit that they're wrong, always have to justify their actions or deflect. But you know, we've all been that defensive person at one point. More than one point in our lives, many times in our lives. Just talking about it reminds me of that emotion, that feeling of pride that wells up when you're starting to get upset, and you're getting upset and ready to unleash whatever your side of the story is, and they're going to hear it. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, to conclude. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3, speaking of the mind of Christ. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. It says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. The core issue with self-defense is pride, deciding that I am more important than the other people. Brethren, let's get to the heart of the matter. Let's work on rooting out the pride in our hearts. Destroying a fellow human being, whether physically or verbally, is never okay. Let's be proactive and determine ahead of time to align ourselves with God's perspective. Let's have the faith to submit to Him, to our Creator, in all circumstances, to entrust our lives to Him according to His will.